In the construction business and tired of dealing with the indifference of big corporate suppliers, Quality Supply and Tool on South Harding Street understands. For over 25 years, owner Kevin Anne has had a different approach.
We at Quality Supply and Tool take pride in being a locally owned family business, committed to service. And every customer's needs are different, and we truly believe in shaping our business to our customers' needs. That's what separates us from the competition.
That's Quality Supply and Tool, with additional locations in Bloomington and Jeffersonville to serve Hoosiers better. Partner with Quality Supply and Tool and think outside the box. Store.
Only the best run here at the Indianapolis 500.
Mario, who do you feel you'll have to beat in this year's race?
People like A.J. Foyt and Bobby Unser, for instance.
Stand by for the checkered flag.
Absolutely incredible. Danny Sullivan spun in front of Mario Andretti.
A.J. has done it. He has won his fourth Indianapolis 500.
Beyond the Bricks with Jay Query and Mike Thompson. Brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5. The Fan.
Hey, good evening to you on a sun-splashed, absolutely gorgeous day today, Monday, in Indianapolis. And race week is here. The 107th running of the Indianapolis 500-mile race. Set to take place, of course, in 6 days. Forecast looks fabulous for that as well. We do know, as I'm sure you heard mentioned on trackside or throughout the course of the day, that unfortunately incident today after a caution-free, except for track inspections, practice and qualifying sessions leading up to today. Today, an incident at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway with Catherine Legg and Stephen Wilson making contact in turn number one. Certainly hope the best for both those drivers that fortunately were awake and alert once the AMR safety team was able to get to them. But we certainly hope the best for a couple of the finer people that you're going to find in the field, both from Great Britain, Stephen Wilson and Catherine Legg. My name is Jake Query. Mike Thompson is here as well. And Mike, kind of fitting as we get set to talk about some of the legends of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway to take a look at the starting grid for this year's race, because one of the real storylines, I thought, amongst many throughout qualifying, one of the real storylines was once you got into that fast 12 and took a look at some of the speeds or even in the top 15, Santino Ferrucci was a great story who was going to start inside of row number two, and then as well the fastest rookie qualifier who will be toasted by the American Dairy Association of Indiana tomorrow with the fastest rookie luncheon, Benjamin Peterson. Both of them driving for the team and the owner. That is one of our topics tonight in our look at the legends of the Speedway.
Yeah, I thought it might be fun to have some sound with legends that we haven't really run these specific sound bites in the past, hearing the legends on different topics. And so we get to hear from leading off tonight, A.J. Foyt, and of course they had a great weekend. I mean, Santino had a great weekend. Obviously, you mentioned Benjamin Peterson. What a surprise Benjamin Peterson was all weekend. So I just thought it'd be fun to hear some clips that we may not have heard in the past of the legends talking to these are interviews I did a few years ago with some legendary drivers talking about topics that we may not have heard from them in the past on.
Well, certainly when you talk about the legends of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, you start with the man where it all began, January 16th of 1935 in Houston, Texas, easy for me to say, when Anthony Joseph Foyt Jr. came into the world. Of course, he would quickly be known as A.J. Foyt. He was the son, like so many probably, Mike, of the drivers of his era, the son of a guy that was known to kind of work on some cars and grab a wrench here and there, and so it didn't take long for young A.J. Foyt to kind of get that, I don't know if you'd say the racing bug, Mike, but he was certainly introduced to the auto mechanic or engine bug at a very young age.
Yeah, and it wasn't long before he not only was grabbing like wrenches out of his dad's garage, he was also grabbing his dad's car. I had heard a story years ago that he had borrowed his dad's midget and tore up the yard driving the midget around, and I always wanted to know whether that story was true or not. So when I had the opportunity to sit one-on-one with AJ, I had to ask that question.
So AJ Foyt, by the way, was given a small racer with a lawnmower engine. Maybe he got it confused with that midget. Who knows? But Mike was able to ask A.J. Foyt about the time that he just went ahead and went for a joyride around the front yard.
I want to ask you about something that I read in your book a long time ago. Did you actually steal one of your dad's midgets and tear up the yard? Did that actually happen?
I hate to admit it. Yes, it did. And I didn't steal it. I just took it off the trailer, and then I had my friends all push and get started, and then kind of backfired because there's carburetors back then and caught fire. And we got it out, but it burnt the paint all off the hood and all that. And it's the one I'm able to talk to you because my daddy was kind of narrow-minded about things like that, because one time I outrun the cops when I was a young boy and reported my car stolen, and I lied to him. I got punished for 1 year at the house. Had to be at the shop every day by 3:30. He took me home. My grandmother and mother begged him on Christmas Eve, let him go out. And it was like a month before it was over with. I said 1 year. And that was it. 1 year.
Gotta love it. Gotta love the old school discipline for A.J. Foyt. But Foyt was still able, even after that Christmas, where he probably had to sit at home. Eventually, he was racing midgets in his own right. He did so, as a matter of fact, starting at the age of 18 in 1953. And what's funny, Mike, is when he first began racing midgets, I guess his father ultimately forgave him because his dad was helping him out in starting out that racing career.
Oh, that's right. I mean, his father sometimes doesn't get enough credit for all the hard work and you know, everything that Tony Foyt, you know, A.J. Foyt Sr., Tony Foyt, you know, did for A.J. Foyt Jr.'s career.
In 1956, A.J. Foyt was in the Night Before the 500 in Anderson, Indiana. That was his first USAC midget start. And then he got his first win in 1957. Then by 1958, Anthony Joseph Foyt Jr. was introduced to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And Mike talked to him about the first time he came to the famed oval at 16th and Georgetown.
I want to ask you about your first time when you were here. In 57, I know you said you watched from the stands and Paul Russo crashed in front of you, and you kind of thought, well, do I even want to do this?
Well, that's quite true, you know. Actually, my first year, rode up with some friends. I was very young, 1955. And in 1957, I was up in turn one when he blew the tire on the great Novi. And then I got thinking, I don't know if me running little short tracks, A.J. Foyt wants to race here. And definitely after my good friend Pat O'Connor helped me on some sprints at Salem, Indiana one time, went over and jumped on a mechanic and said, I told Pat, I said, this car is doing this and that. And he went on felt and he told the mechanic, you're trying to kill this kid? And they fixed it. And I had a lot of respect for him. And then the first year in 58 when all that tragic accident, and then he, you know, lost his life. And that's when I really decided, I don't know, this might be a little rough for this kid.
Well, 1958 was his rookie year as a driver. A.J. Foyt, as a matter of fact, started 12th, finished 16th. He spun on lap 148, managed to finish the race in 59. A clutch dropped him out in 1960. And then in 1961, A.J. Foyt did something that no one would probably anticipate he would do another three times. Mike was able to ask him about his first win of the Indianapolis 500.
You know, you were leading, you had that situation where you didn't get all the fuel in, and you had to be kind of just disconsolate when they told you, hey, you got to come back in again, and then Eddie comes in again.
Well, that's quite true. You know, when they give me the board, you didn't have all the radios like you have today, late stop. And I'm thinking, what do they mean, late stop? And then they put late stop fuel, you can see the board. And I'm saying to myself, man, this is hell no. I have it. I felt like I had it won, then I lost it. And then when I come in, and then Eddie, all that time, had a load of fuel and was trying to run with me with a light load of fuel, so he actually wore the right front out. And when he did come in, I think three or four laps or whatever it was, two laps, I don't recall, but his tire done wore through two layers of card. I mean, he couldn't have probably went through one more turn. He pushed it to the limit, and there's one deal that you raced hard all day, you felt like you had it won, you lost it, and then it comes back and you win. So that normally don't happen here.
And I'll tell you, Jake, obviously, you know, A.J. Foyt, you know what a legend he is and, you know, what an incredible person A.J. Foyt is. One of the greatest honors of my life was getting to sit with A.J. Foyt for a half hour sit down interview. And you will understand this, but maybe people at home may or may not understand. When you ask A.J. Foyt a question and his first response is, well, this is quite true, you won't believe what a smile that put on my face. I mean, I got that several times, and every time I asked A.J. Foyt a question, he said, well, that's quite true. that's just validation to me. I don't know how you would feel about that, Jake, but that to me was one of the greatest moments of my life, because I asked AJ Foyt a question and he answered with, well, that's quite true. I mean, I felt like I really had made it that day.
Well, this is quite true. Robin Miller had a great video that he did on YouTube, the late, great Robin Miller, who had one of the great ups and downs, mostly up, relationships with AJ Foyt. They were very close for the last probably 20 years of Robin Miller's life. And Robin did a fabulous video of all of the AJ Foyt euphemisms. And none of them was AJ Foyt more synonymous with than, well, this is quite true. But AJ Foyt is a race car driver. When you say that he was the most accomplished driver, certainly domestically speaking, I think one would say this is quite true. His list of accomplishments, virtually unprecedented. He won a USAC Sprint Car Series Championship. He won a USAC Champ Car Championship. He won a USAC Stock Car Championship. He won a USAC Silver Crown Championship. He won an IROC Championship. He is the only driver to win the Indianapolis 500 four times, the Daytona 500, the 24 Hours of Daytona, the 24 Hours of Le Mans, the 12 Hours of Sebring. He's in the International Motorsports Hall of Fame, the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Hall of Fame. He was named the co-driver of the century by the Associated Press, obviously for the 20th century. Listed as one of NASCAR's 50 greatest drivers, National Sprint Car Hall of Fame, Motorsports Hall of Fame of America, National Midget Auto Racing Hall of Fame, one of NASCAR's 75 greatest drivers in 2023, 128 races in NASCAR over the course of 30 years with 7 wins and 36 top 10s, and then, of course, the all-time winningest driver when it comes to USAC and open wheel racing. So Mike simply asked AJ Foyt the question, with all of that, all of the accolades, all of the accomplishment, all of the trophies, the Hall of Fames, everything that goes into it, what was it like to accomplish everything there was to accomplish in the sport of racing?
With all your accomplishments, everything you've done, four-time winner, like we listed them all a few minutes ago, all the championships, all the wins, is there anything in racing you didn't do that you wanted to do?
To be truthful with you, no. Because I went to all the midget races I wanted to, the sprint car races, and even like the day afterwards, I can't remember, I think it was 64 or 67, they had a race at New Bremen, Ohio. And so I loaded up my sprint car, and it was my own car. I was going over it with Jed Larson before he lost his life. He said, well, if you win this race, I'm driving your car. I said, no. So I pulled in kind of late with the car, and he was driving somebody else. He come over, he said, I told you, you're not driving, you're taking the day off. So I unloaded the car, and he practiced with it, and he won the feature going away. And I said, damn it, Judd. He said, no, I told you, I was going to drive your car. So, that's one thing. I used to go to Terre Haute with Don Smith. I'd rate him just as hard over there for $2 as I did for $2 million. It made no difference on the purse.
You know, Mike, I'll be honest with you. It is so similar to a guy, and there are so many drivers that, of course, have looked up to, emulated, understandably so, and patterned themselves after AJ Foyt. And that story right there, if you were to put it into modern terms, not that AJ Foyt's not modern, but that is Tony Stewart through and through. You know what I mean? Tony Stewart will run at Terre Haute, or he'll run at Eldora, or he will run at Daytona, and it doesn't matter what the purse is or how many people are watching on television. He's there for one reason only, and that's to finish ahead of you.
That's right. Tony Stewart, Kyle Larson, all cut from the AJ Foyt cloth. There's no doubt about that.
AJ Foyt, of course, just one of the legends of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. We'll hear from a few more when we come back to Beyond the Bricks.
The construction industry in Indiana has depended on Quality Supply and Tool, a local family-owned business, to deliver quality sales and service over the last 25 years. The employees make the difference, like sales expert Nick Worley.
What sets us apart is we only offer quality tools and supplies from quality manufacturers. We have a quality trained sales and service staff knowledgeable of the products we sell and offer. Quality. It's in our name.
On South Harding Street in Indy, plus Bloomington and Jeffersonville, Quality Supply and Tool thinks outside the box. Store.
Coming to James Tavern for dinner is like coming home. Home to the friendly, inviting traditions of America. Cordial service, charming atmosphere, hearty dining, as you'll discover when you savor our Savannah pork rib roast, tender New England scrod, or Cascade flounder almondine. And for a big finish, now there's something very special. The Strawberry Finish Line. A tantalizing dessert bar reminiscent of old-time strawberry lawn festivals. You'll find fresh strawberries prepared in the most appealing ways. Strawberry shortcake. Fresh strawberries with sour cream and brown sugar. Strawberry pie. And that aristocrat of strawberrydom, strawberry chantilly. Made with strawberries, whipped cream, and Grand Marnier. Come home soon to James Tavern. After the Indy 500, make your dinner a winner, too, at James Tavern, 8601 Keystone at the Crossings.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
You had to do it to me, didn't you, Mike?
It's time for that aristocrat of strawberry dump.
You know we've been doing this show for a while together when I can't keep a straight face without the sounds of the strawberry. I mean, that was the longest. I'm not kidding you, Mike. We've done this show for 3 years. We have played starting lineups from like the Mutual broadcasts from 1952, where they listed 33 drivers, the sponsors, the hometown, the average speed, the car manufacturer, all in a shorter amount of time than that fella just listed off the strawberry menu, right?
Well, that's because of the strawberries and sour cream and brown sugar and everything else they put together in that.
Good Lord. It's a wonder the place isn't still around. Jake Query, Mike Thompson here. It is Beyond the Bricks. We're taking a look at some of the legends of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. There is perhaps, obviously, as we talked about A.J. Foyt when it comes to American racing, I don't know that you find a bigger legend. But then again, when it comes to international fame and claim as the most versatile accomplished race car driver in the world, then I don't know that you could necessarily go any further or have to go any further than Mario Andretti, who is, of course, one of the great ambassadors today for open wheel racing, for the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, for the Indianapolis 500. He certainly needs no introduction or explanation. 29 Indianapolis 500 starts. He won the race in 1969. Mike, I think it's safe to say that when you talk about somebody who is synonymous with racing worldwide, I don't know even to this day still that anybody's name resonates more than Mario Andretti.
I would agree with that. I mean, you can be a casual fan. I mean, even my mother-in-law, I mentioned Mario Andretti and her ears perk up because she doesn't follow racing very much or anything like that. But I mentioned Mario Andretti and she immediately knows the name Mario Andretti, things like that. So you're right. I mean, he's just such a global icon and he's such an incredible ambassador for the sport.
Literally, his name has become a euphemism for speed. Anytime that you're referenced by the Charlie Daniels Band, you're referenced by Ice Cube, for that matter. There are a few that would be like a greater pendulum amongst the pop cultural references in which Mario Andretti's name has become so well known. We don't need to necessarily lead or list, I should say, everything in which he won, every trophy that he accumulated. But he has been an inspiration to so many throughout the sport of racing. The question Mike asked Mario Andretti, which is a darn good one, for somebody who is a racing hero to so many, who exactly was Mario Andretti's racing hero?
Well, what was captivating was the fact that at the time when I became enamored with Formula One, of course, Ferrari being at the forefront, you know, Formula One, of course, and Maserati, Alfa Romeo, you know, being all these major brands, you know, part of Formula One. And then Alberto Ascari was world champion, you know, when I was a teenager, you know, at the early teens, you know, he was world champion 53, 54. Of course, you know, the world champion, everybody talks about him, and he looked cool. I love the way the press used to describe him, you know, like he had ice in his veins and all that. These are all the things that I think capture your imagination as a kid, and And he was just a cool-looking dude, you know, that you always figure, oh, man, I want to be just like him when I grow up type of thing.
One of my favorite passages in that book was when you came to America and you said, you know, here's Aldo and I looking like the great Ascari in our Italian-made coveralls. And when you came to America, I know you were like, I'm not sure I really kind of want to do this. And then you found a dirt oval in Nazareth, Pennsylvania. And how special was that when you first heard that sound? It was a different kind of racing than you were used to, but it had to have really grabbed you.
Well, quite honestly, we arrived here in the United States in Nazareth on a Thursday. It was June Thursday. So the season was in full swing, you know, with the local stock car racing. And we were at my uncle's house, which was about maybe a mile and a half away from the fairgrounds. And it was on a Sunday night. And we're just there, just hanging out. And all of a sudden, we see bright lights in the background, you know. And we hear this roar of engines all of a sudden. And Aldo and I just looked at each other, and we just followed that noise. And then we just peeked through the fence there, and then we see these brute-looking modified stock cars. And, you know, the last race that we saw was the Grand Prix of Monza, you know, Italian Grand Prix of Monza. And, but again, I always keep saying, by looking at that, it looked very doable. Like, you know, all of a sudden, Aldo and I look at each other and say, man, you know, we could do this. Like, 2 years later, we started building a car just to race right there, you know, a stock car. We were 17 years old 2 years later, and then the objective was to race. By the time we reached 21, which in those days you had to be 21 to race legally, professionally. And but the car was done, was finished when we were 19, so we had to fudge our birth date on our license. We had a guy to do that for us, and then so all of a sudden we were 21, but 19.
The story for Mario Andretti, of course, begins even before that, when he was born in Italy in the area that is now Croatia, on February 28th of 1940. But the area, of course, you're talking about in Europe during the war, in World War II, and the area in which he lived in Italy underwent a lot of different changes, becoming part of, as I mentioned, now Croatia, but for a while it went from the Kingdom of Italy, and then it became part of Yugoslavia, and the Treaty of Paris and different treaties changed things and made it so that it was not easy, of course, being Italian in that time period. Many of them, of course, living in refugee camps throughout Italy, including the Andretti family. When Mario was 15 years old, his father, who had been a farmer throughout Italy, decided to follow the example, if you will, and the advice of a family member to settle, as you heard Mario mention, in Nazareth, Pennsylvania. Originally, they were only going to come to the United States for 5 years, but of course, that changed, and by the time 5 years had already gone past, Mario Andretti was very accomplished along with his twin brother Aldo in their racing career. You just heard Mario mention that came with maybe a little bit of liberty in talking about their age when they began racing. But the twist to all of it was the fact that Mario Andretti, before he would become the most famous race car driver in the world, the world might know of Mario Andretti, but initially his father did not realize that Mario was in fact a racer.
Well, you know, we didn't dare tell our dad because, you know, he was not up to speed on motor racing, but all he knew about was, you know, what the press always talked about, the fatalities, which, you know, were, you know, pretty much the order of the day in those times. And as, you know, on the way over on a ship, that was during the 24 Hours of Le Mans, and that was the year when they had that horrible accident where Pierre Levesque wound up in a grandstand killing 85 spectators. So those were the news that my dad knew about motor racing. And so whenever we would read about racing, he said, oh, you crazy kids. And there's no way that he would have really allowed us to even do it. So, as you said, we our first season, we had to do it to protect ourselves. You know, we had to just not say anything. To protect ourselves, it was actually the language barrier, quite honestly, because it took them a lot longer to learn English than we did. And again, and the unfortunate thing is that he had to find out, you know, when Aldo got hurt at the very last race of the season in Hatfield, Pennsylvania. And in some ways, he probably felt that he was vindicated, you know, thinking, okay, you guys do something like that, you're going to be, so they're going to bring you home in a body bag or something. And the worst thing was that the following year, when he found out that we were racing it, he thought that we learned a lesson, you know. But, you know, actually, while Aldo was still in a coma, quite honestly, I kept whispering to him. I said, hey, Aldo, you know, I'm already building a new car to drive. You know, the doctor said, just talk to him about anything that actually would, you know, and excite him. And that he, and that's what I kept telling him. You know, say, Aldo, yeah, don't worry. You know, we're going to have a new car and all that sort of thing. In fact, when it came around, the first thing he said to me, he said, I'm glad you had to be the one to face the old man.
Mario was very gracious to do that interview with me, and he gave me so much of his time and was so willing to, you know, answer my questions about his early career and early life. And one of the things I wanted to talk to him about was when he won in 1964, he had a book that he put out in after winning the 500 in 69, he put a book out with Bob Collins called What's It Like Out There. And I actually used to take that book out of my junior high library so much that they eventually actually gave me the book because they were so sick of me taking it out of the library all the time. And so I learned a lot about Mario as a kid. And one of the things I learned about was his win at Salem in 1964 in the Joe James Pat O'Connor race, and how important that was when he got that win for Rufus Gray, and how important Rufus Gray, a name that people may not know. Rufus Gray was a USAC car owner in sprint cars, and Rufus Gray was really instrumental in helping Mario get moved on in championship cars. And I had to ask Mario about getting that win in Rufus Gray.
Your first big win in USAC, in the book you talk about how special that was for you at Salem with Rufus Gray. To this day, I mean, I can see the smile on your face thinking about that win. And you say in the book how, you know, that trophy still honored, it's an honored place in your house. How big was that? Was that the day that you really knew, hey, I've arrived, when you won that against the big USAC stars?
Well, that's the point. You just said that, you know, just being among the top drivers, which in those days, you know, all the top dudes were driving sprint cars as well, you know, and midgets and so forth. And so when you mix it up with those guys and you're able to pull off a win, then you feel, okay, maybe I belong here. You know, it gives you a wonderful feeling of confidence, of course, and these are all the things that you're looking for. It's up to that point, everything's a stepping stone. You know, every time when you win, you know, you feel you're going to move forward, you know. But then at this point, I was just looking for the ultimate, you know. From there, you move to champ cars, and that, you know, that all of a sudden, you know, the word gets around, you know, okay, there's a new kid on the block, and all, and then they start paying attention. And Rufus Gray is probably was catalyst, you know, in giving me the opportunity to really at the right time in USAC for me to be able to move from there to champ cars. Because when Chuck Hulse got hurt in New Bremen, you know, sort of somebody suggested to Clint Brauner, hey, why don't you give the kid a try? And he did. And that, you know, that was godsend for me, because I was one of the top three teams, you know, that was capable of doing the winning. And that's where I needed to be. And then, of course, with Firestone, he being one of the Firestone teams, and then having the big tire war with Goodyear, then we were able to get, you know, he was able to give me a lot of seat time testing. And Firestone embraced me pretty quick, you know, as a test driver, because they just liked the fresh input they were getting from me, you know, not being established. I was coming to them, you know, in a different way, because I was just brutally honest with what was going on. And sometimes when you get more experienced drivers, they're set in their ways. Sometimes they even tell the engineers what they want to hear, type of thing. So it all worked out tremendously for me. And again, going back to Rufus Gray, what he did for me was just phenomenal.
Obviously, what he did was help Mario get that big win. But racing inevitably also comes not just with wins, which Mario Andretti had plenty, but loss as well. And sometimes that means the loss of competitors, and in Mario Andretti's case, the loss of friends.
You had two people that I know were close friends. Billy Foster was really close to you, yeah. And Ronnie. And losing those two, I know that's had a profound effect on your life.
Yeah, yeah. Things are never the same. You know, it's as you say, you know, when you develop this friendship, I mean, we have a lot of friends out there, but we were, you know, our families were together, their wives and kids, you know, and we spend inordinate amount of time, you know, together, and that's what makes it really tough. And yes, I consider Billy Foster my best friend at the time, you know, when he was killed, and then Ronnie the same way, because we just had such great time together. We used to just raise hell, period, you know, and have fun doing it, you know, on and off the track. And on the track, you know, we respected one another, but off the track, we just doing stupid things that we had fun with. And then to lose them was just, you know, again, just it's a tough one.
When we come back, yet another legend at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. In fact, speaking of loss, sadly, one that we lost within the last couple of years. But we will take a look back at one of the other great icons at 16th and Georgetown on this Monday edition of Beyond the Bricks.
In the construction business and tired of dealing with the indifference of big corporate suppliers, Quality Supply and Tool on South Harding Street understands. For over 25 years, owner Kevin Ane has had a different approach.
We at Quality Supply and Tool take pride in being a locally owned family business, committed to service. And every customer's needs are different, and we truly believe in shaping our business to our customers' needs. That's what separates us from the competition.
That's Quality Supply and Tool, with additional locations in Bloomington and Jeffersonville to serve Hoosiers better. Partner with Quality Supply and Tool and think outside the box. Store.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Jake Query, Mike Thompson, Eddie Garrison, Sam Fritz. This is Beyond the Bricks here on Race Week in Indianapolis, the 107th running of the Indianapolis 500-mile race. Set to take place in 6 days, and hallelujah. Final practice today, by the way, before carb day, I should say. Certainly hoping the best for Catherine Legg and Stephen Wilson, involved in an incident in turn number one today. Good news, both getting out underneath their own power, but we shall see what that means moving forward. Backup cars certainly would probably be in order for both, but we shall see. Also want to let you know, this is the 107th running of the Indianapolis 500-mile race this year. But that's not to say that there's not plenty, whether it be ticket stubs, programs, buttons, whatever it may be, that is of your fancy of the races of the past. The Memorabilia Show is the place to be this Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. 4 until 8 o'clock on Thursday, 3 until 8 o'clock on Friday, 9 until 4 o'clock on Saturday. Now, the Indianapolis 500 Memorabilia Show, you're saying, Jake, that's wonderful. You gave me that information. Where is it? The Embassy Suites Event Center in Plainfield. Embassy Suites Event Center in Plainfield. Tickets are just $7, or if you plan on going all 3 days, $15 covers you for all 3 days. So a bargain right there. Mike Thompson will be there as well, which many would say is actually right there the primary reason why you would want to attend. Taking a look tonight, talking about some of the legends of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And I think certainly if you were talking Mount Rushmore, which is a pretty tired topic when it comes to sports, but it's very clear at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway who is in that upper echelon. You have four now four-time winners. One of them, Elio Castroneves, will still attempt to get his fifth. He will be doing so on Sunday. Of course, Rick Mears, who is still involved at the Speedway and still seen. He had been a driver coach, for that matter, for Castroneves for a number of years. And then, of course, the second four-time winner. We heard from
A.J. Foyt. We heard from Mario Andretti, who is a giant in racing. Alitzer Sr., who, of course, raced in, I think, probably the most famous or popular race car, the Johnny Lightning Special in 1970 and 1971, winning back-to-back years at the Indy 500. He eventually would become the all-time lap leader. Scott Dixon has since surpassed that, but he would win again in 1978, win in 1987. An illustrious, a decorated career. And like what we heard from A.J. Foyt, perhaps racing began for Alitzer Sr. in terms of getting behind the wheel of a car when he wasn't supposed to, and when he might have actually been doing so, leading to the scorn from his elders. Alitzer Sr. on an incident that happened to him as well back in his childhood.
When you were a young kid, your mom, I guess, used to tell the story that you, when you were a young kid, I guess you rolled one of the cars. You were like 8 or 9 years old, and I guess she was too proud of you to even punish you for that. Is that really true?
Yes, it is. Yeah, it was a Model A pickup, and I was running right kind of, my brothers had a kind of a racetrack laid out there that they were running super modifieds by then. In Albuquerque, and so I was out there one day and rolled it over and went back in the shop and asked for some help to get it back before my parents got back from downtown. And they just laughed at me. Well, they helped me. My brothers helped me, and the employees that my father had there helped me. But as soon as my parents got back, it wasn't 5 minutes before my father called me in. So, you know, he knew more than I thought he knew, you know, or my brothers or the employees told him, you know, that I just rolled the car, the Model A, over.
I would imagine eventually, Mike, when it came to his exploits behind a wheel, his dad probably forgave him, correct?
I think that's probably the case, since it was a racing family, and they, you know, they were probably used to all that stuff.
I would think. Alitzer came to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway in 1965, and as you'd mentioned, a racing family, obviously. His father, his brothers, we know that. Eventually, his son as well. In 1965, he arrived at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway in a pretty decorated rookie class. Alitzer, from the get-go, showed an acumen for being able to do what he did best, which was bring the car home safely. He was running at the end of the race. He finished ninth in his rookie campaign in the Sheraton Thompson Lola Ford. Then in 1966, he got an opportunity to drive a Lotus.
Well, you know, the next year, you know, I run for Frank Harrison the rest of the year, Jerry Isaac and Frank Harrison. And, you know, we tried hard. I was a rookie, you know, there's where you can look back at your rookie years and say, well, it was really a good training ground for me. And it was, because it was a, you know, a stock lock engine, a Chevy engine that Jerry Isaac and Frank Harrison was trying to get, you know, to go fast. And Jerry Isaac built his own cars, built the cars. So, you know, you look at the car, he had a lot of good ideas, terrific ideas. And, you know, it was just one of those deals that then the next year when Jimmy Clark or Andy Granatelli comes and makes a phone call to me and he says, do you have a ride for this year's race? And I said, well, I'm with Frank Harrison. He says, do you have a contract with him? I said, well, no, not exactly, just word of mouth. He says, you fly back to Chicago, because I want to talk to you. And I just, you know, he says, I want to put you in the Lotus with Jimmy Clark. I said, boy, I mean, I couldn't believe the words, you know. And so I jumped on an airplane and flew back there, and make a long story short, you know, we signed a contract, and then I had to call Jerry Isaac and Frank Harrison and tell them that I'd signed the contract with Andy Granatelli and Team Lotus. And that was hard to do, but, you know, it was one of those deals that it bettered my standards, you know, of trying to get a car that I knew would make the race. And, of course, that was Lotus had just won the race, you know. So it was a fun deal.
And that 1966 race, Al Unser started 23rd. He would finish 12th. 1967, he started 9th, and then again in a pattern, he would bring the car home in this second position. He had an accident, by the way, in 1966. In 1968, he started in 6th, and another accident finished in 26th. Then something happened before he would win back-to-back races in 70 and 71, Mike, where Al Unser probably still thinks about the fact, or thought about, I should say, before passing away, thought about the fact that that 1969 race, suddenly he was found himself in an uncomfortable and an unusual situation.
Yeah, that's right. A very unusual situation. You look at his record and people say, well, wait a minute, why wasn't Al Unser in the 1969 race? Well, that's because of rain, indirectly. Since it rained, he and Parnelli Jones decided to do a little motorcycle riding in the infield and ended up with Al Unser in the hospital. So I actually had the opportunity to ask him about that.
We were in the garage area, and if you look up in the record books, that was the first weekend of qualifying, and it was raining. So it rained out Saturday for qualifying. So Parnelli, we're standing in the garage, and he says, let's take a ride on the bikes until the crowd gets out of here. You know, we'll just kill some time. I said, sure. We jumped on the motorcycles, and we were just riding around in the infield, you know, and not doing wheelies or anything like that. You know, I wasn't. And because I wasn't that good on a motorcycle, so I sure wasn't. And I went down in a bar ditch, kind of, I call them a little side road ditch, you know, for drainage of water. And when I came out, I was sitting too far back on the bike, and the bike did the wheelie, and I just kicked the bike loose. Well, the bike stopped in midair and fell over, and the kickstand went through my ankle, gave me a compound fracture. Well, that just, you know, Parnelli comes running over to me and he says, you okay? I says, I think I broke my ankle, my leg. He's, no, you didn't. No, you didn't. He says, you'll be all right. Well, we went to the hospital and it was a compound fracture.
You guys were tough back then. I mean, yeah, you're all right. Rub some dirt on it, right? You can get back in the car, right?
Unser, of course, would win the Indy 500 in 1970 and 71. Then in 1978, drives for Jim Hall, wins his third Indianapolis 500, returns to drive for him in 1979, but then left the team after that. Al Unser on that decision.
Well, you know, I made myself a promise, and once I left Bell and Parnelli, that any time that I was not happy again, I would leave. Because if you're not happy, I don't think that you can produce what you should be able to produce in the race car if you're not happy. So when Jim Hall and I didn't get along, I just said bye-bye, you know. And I knew I was giving up a good car, you know. It's one of those deals, but you have to be happy within yourself and the team that you're with. And I wasn't, so that's why I left him. It was a competitive team as he hired Johnny Rutherford, and Johnny wins the race, you know, with the car. And Johnny benefited, you know, from me quitting, but I'm still not sorry today. I was not happy. So I made myself a promise that if I wasn't happy with the next team, I was going to leave them, and that's just what I did.
Al Unser, of course, would go on to win his third Indianapolis 500 for Roger Penske, fourth Indianapolis 500 for Roger Penske in 1987. Interesting, the storyline of each of our legends tonight talking about influence of their fathers from young ages. Al Unser Jr. in 1989 had the opportunity to go out and demonstrate his displeasure with Emerson Fittipaldi late in the race in an accident. He recently told me that he decided to give a thumbs up when he realized that Al Unser Sr. had once told him, if you act up, you don't race. Thanks for listening to Beyond the Bricks.